From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today, we are adding another dynamic Georgian to our series of conversations with women UGA graduates. The school began admitting women in 1918. Allison Osmond began her career at Delta in 1985 as a flight attendant. Today, she is Senior Vice President of In-Flight Service, leading a team of 23,000 flight attendants around the world. And she's joining us now in the studio. Allison, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thank you for being here. Let's go to back before you were at Delta. You were a broadcaster, a radio broadcaster. How did you get into broadcasting?
So that's what I majored in at UGA, which was fantastic. Still use the degree every day.
I want to hear more about
that. No, but, I think communication can influence many things. Mm-hmm. And with the group I have today, it helps to have that background. But, no, that is, in college, majored in journalism with a, minor in political science and wanted to get into the broadcast world and graduated from UGA. Got a job at TBS working midnight to 8 in the morning.
The old pioneer shift.
That's right. And, I was getting married at the time, and so it didn't quite fit my schedule. And at the time, I thought I've kind of given up my dream, even though it was behind the camera. I thought, have I really given up my dream job? And so left there and then went to my local radio station, did the morning show, and then did some sales, radio ads in the afternoon. So I did a little bit of everything. So it was great. Easy listening radio station in Henry County. So it was fun.
Easy listening in the morning.
Yes.
Wait, you're kind of bucking the trend. When did you decide to try something else?
Yeah, so I stayed there for, I did that for about a year and a half. And again, in my small town, live in McDonough, Georgia, and wanted to really get on with a larger corporation. And I thought, I could certainly use what I did in radio and my degree and get into public relations. For me, living, growing up in Atlanta, near Atlanta, it was either Coke or Delta.
Mm-hmm.
And I really loved the culture of Delta, had heard so many great things about it. So I thought I'll try for Delta and I'll get into public relations at Delta. And it was really interesting at the time. This was 1985. And I applied for a public relations job and I have it hanging in my office today. I was declined.
Really?
Yes.
On what grounds?
Well, back 34 years ago, to get into a job, really into one of our administrative jobs within Delta, you had to start on the front lines.
Mm.
Even our CEOs at the time, Ron Allen started on the ramp at Delta and worked his way up to CEO. So I went back to Delta and I said, okay, I'm determined to get into Delta, get a public relations job. And they said, well, your choices are to start out on the front line. You can be a reservation agent, cabin service, ACS, in-flight.
What's ACS?
Airport customer service.
Yeah.
Or a mechanic or a flight attendant. And I thought, I'd flown a few times and I said, okay, well, I'll go, I'll try to be a flight attendant. And so fortunate enough, I was hired and I wouldn't give anything for starting my career as a flight attendant.
Well, I think that's really interesting to build into the corporate culture that you begin at the bottom rung. What does that do to the way you think about the organization you work for?
It keeps it real for me every single second of every day. When you think about Delta, we've got 80,000 employees today. Everything we all do culminates in that cabin on board that airplane. And it takes all of us to make it happen. And to know that I've been at the center, at the heartbeat of all that we do at Delta, and I've walked down that 17.5-inch runway on board the airplane, it's a special feeling to have done that. And I think for me and the role that I play today at Delta, I can truly walk the shoes of the people that I serve every day, which I need to do and still do. So I keep my flight attendant qualifications up and still go fly from time to time.
You do?
I do.
So what is that like as a person who's kind of surveying the scene rather than just the customers who are sitting there?
Yeah, well, I just worked a trip 2 months ago out to San Diego and back. And it was funny, the flight attendant crew, when I showed up, was like, are you really going to work? And I'm like, yes, I'm going to work. I don't think they thought I could still do it, but
Did they all sort of, you know, stand up a little straighter because the big boss is in the house?
I don't know. Maybe a little bit. But, you know, I feel like I'm one of them. And certainly when I'm, you know, in the aisle on board the airplane, I am. And it's a great feeling. And, you know, it's about, we say all the time, for the customer, it's just about getting from point A to point B. But for us at Delta, and particularly the flight attendant, you know, it's got to be about the journey. And it's all in what we make it on board that airplane. So,
which routes did you work initially?
When I first started flying, amazingly enough, Delta did not have many international flights. Mm-hmm. We flew to Frankfurt and flew to London, I think, at the time. And so I flew for about 5.5 years. I did everything from Raleigh to Tampa to, you know, San Francisco, mainly West Coast. I was based in Boston mm-hmm. when I first started flying. So that was interesting to live in another part of the U.S. and get to know it. And I flew one international trip to Frankfurt, and that was it. And now look at Delta today, and we're global and fly everywhere. So.
Well, I'm wondering about you, you know, growing up in McDonough, Georgia, you know, yes. seeing this whole big wide world. Did that change your perspective on where you lived?
It changed my perspective about everything yeah. and, you know, just diversity and, you know, whether that's food, religion, geography, you know, everything. It makes you very thankful mm-hmm. for obviously how blessed we are in the United States. But at the same time, just how broad the world is, and people are just fascinating, and the places that we can go and see and enjoy. So it's been fantastic.
I'm speaking with Allison Osben. She's Delta Senior Vice President and McDonough native, and her career with Delta began as a flight attendant. And at first, those professions do seem very different, you know, broadcaster and flight attendant. But as you said, it has served you because you're connecting with strangers, I guess, in many cases. Is that the way you thought of it?
Yeah, I think, you know, when you think about 20, and we're up to now 24,000 flight attendants, they live around the world. And it is hard. It's a different way of connecting because you don't see them every day. They're not all in the same place at the same time. So, you know, all the things I learned at University of Georgia about writing and particularly broadcasting and being succinct and being, you know, it's and the transparency that you always want to have, you know, from a broadcasting perspective. So the integrity, the credibility, all of those things today I need to use with a team of 24,000 to make sure that we're, you know, they're a huge part of Delta's success. I need them to know that, but there's always something going on in the world. And so continuing to figure out the best way to communicate in the most succinct way has really been beneficial for me.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that back in the day, people generally worked in the same office, same place, but your flight attendants, your employees all over the place. So you had to communicate and make that norm. How do you do that? You know, how do you create a norm that they get a sense of who you are?
Yeah, there are multiple. We use multiple channels to communicate because you can imagine we have flight attendants who are graduating from college. They're 21 years old up to their 80s. They've been with Delta 55 years. And so you've got different styles that we have to communicate. So therefore, a multitude of channels. But one of the things I think that the flight attendants would say and I get really good feedback on is I do really a weekly blog of what's on my mind, and I know, and typically it's what's on their mind mm-hmm. that I try to counter. So that's one I know that they count on from a consistent basis. But we use social media, all kinds of social media. Not so much memos anymore. Those are a thing of the past. They're few and far between, but still a little bit of that and a lot of emails.
So let's talk about the customers that you were serving on the plane. Do you remember, as a young flight attendant, ever being starstruck by somebody who was on a plane, for example?
Well, being a University of Georgia grad, I had Herschel Walker on. And
woo!
When I was at Georgia, that was Herschel Walker's era. So, you know, once I'd graduated and flown and he was flying, I was completely starstruck. Dionne Warwick, If there you go. Anybody remembers Dionne Warwick, who I'm a huge fan of, flew with her one day. So those were always those moments where you just think, please don't let me spill anything. Please let me. But they were fun.
How about difficult customers? That must have happened now and again.
Yes. You know, and that's one of those things. That was a life lesson, I think. For me, early in my career, you just never know what people are going through. You never know who we're carrying on that airplane and what they need, how they want to be valued that day. And I was flying. I was working the first class on a 727. I'm dating myself. But there was a woman sitting in first class who was, you know, at that moment was probably one of the, you know, just extremely rude, extremely unhappy, you could tell. And, you know, I'd learned through flight attendant training and other customer service roles I had had out of high school working different jobs, you know, that I just needed to remove myself from the situation for a minute. You know, I went back to the galley, you know, heard my training center instructor, you know, tell me how to defuse the situation. And I thought, you know what, I've got to do everything. I'm just going to go back out there. I'm going to make this customer, I'm going to connect with this, find a way to connect and make this customer happy, do my best. Went back out, tried to get a conversation going with the customer, and it just so happened that we were carrying her son below.
Oh.
And I still think about it. I can still have that feeling in my gut today that those people are all around us, whether they're in our office or on board that airplane. And I, you know, it's a very sad story, but it was an opportunity for me for that day to make that journey of hers that was the most difficult journey of her life, I know, just a little bit better by doing everything I could to help her out. You know, with the time that I had with her. So that's been something that I tell often a lot to flight attendants, because I think sometimes when you're working with the public and in a customer service role, it's not always going to be happy, but everybody carries some baggage around. And it's our job, right, to do everything we can to make it, make the experience as good as it can be, albeit the situation. So that was a tough one, but one that has been impactful for me throughout my whole career. So,
I think we're going to take a little break, but we should leave listeners with a little Dionne Warwick. If they don't know who she is, they need to be reminded.
That sounds awesome.
What do we want? Say a little prayer for you.
Say a little, yes.
Seems fitting for the moment. Allison Osmond is with us. We're going to continue our conversation. She's now Senior Vice President of In-Flight Service at Delta, but she got her start back in 1985 as a Delta flight attendant.
The moment I wake up, before I put on my makeup, I say a little prayer for you. I'll comb in my hair now, and wondering what dress to wear now, I say a little prayer for you. Forever, forever, you'll stay in my heart, and I will love you forever and ever. We never will part, oh how I'll love you. Together, together, that's how it must be. To live without you would only mean heartbreak for you. Run for the bus, dear. Oh, while riding, I think of us, dear.
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott, and my guest is Allison Osmond. She's now Senior Vice President of In-Flight Service at Delta. She started back in 1985 as a Delta flight attendant. Well, of course, the terrorist attacks on 9/11 really changed air travel forever. Now, you were traveling on that day, weren't you?
Yes. And I would say, as I look back on my career and really my life, that was the most difficult, challenging time of my entire life. I had flown into New York the night before. Never forget, you think back, and I remember flying in, looking at the city. It was a rainy, you know, dark clouds the night before. Mm-hmm. And then We had flight attendant meetings at our JFK terminal the next morning. It started at 9 o'clock.
Oh, so just after the first
That's right.
plane hit.
We were all in a group room at the airport, and you know, it's and we had. I'm dating myself again, but you had pagers. You know,
I had one too.
No cell phones. And, you know, you could see, visibly see dark smoke, you know, coming up at the time. And, you know, what we heard and what we knew at the time was that a small plane, you know, had hit one of the buildings. That was kind of the initial.
Right. We didn't even know it was a commercial airliner
That's right.
at that point.
That's right. And, you know, obviously the day unfolded and it was just surreal to be in JFK with no people, everybody, you know, eventually left the terminal. But, you know, to then face, okay, we've got, and at the time, we probably had 21,000 flight attendants. Flight attendants, customers everywhere around the world where they weren't supposed to be. Mm. And how do we get in touch with them to make sure they're okay? You know, how do we make sure that they have what they need? You know, our biggest concern was how do we communicate? How do we get in touch with them? And so we were in a small office in JFK, spent the next 5 days, that whole week. We launched conference calls at the time to try to get word to flight attendants to call in, and we'll help you figure out how we can get you home, what are our next steps are. And then I'll never forget, you know, coming home that Saturday, Grand Central Station, you know, just firemen being in, you know, being there just with soot all over them. Mm. One that we were talking to had been looking for his brother all night long. And what everybody went through was just, it was just surreal. And took the train home. And then, you know, to come back, I think it was that was on a Saturday. On a Monday and Tuesday, we started back flying. And I went to Boston, which is where...
Right, one of the flights took off from.
That's right. And I'll never forget being in the, you know, in the gatehouse, and you could have heard, I mean, a pin drop. But I think it was important for me and us to get back to the public and to our Delta team to say, it's okay, it's safe, you can start flying again, and particularly for the flight attendants. And they were very mindful, right, of who's coming on and off the airplane and very fearful of that.
I can imagine.
You know, and trying to build their confidence back up. But it was a obviously horrible time, tragedy for the U.S. and all the families. That was a very, very difficult time.
And I hadn't thought before what it must be like for somebody who is a flight attendant or a pilot to think about, for example, knowing the story now of United Flight 93, you know,
right.
when they discovered that there were, you know, people on board who were wanted to take the plane down and fought them off. Could you imagine yourself in that situation?
Yeah, just, I mean, you know, the courage and the bravery, right, to stand up and, you know, but I will, it's attributable to, obviously, there were customers were, right, helping the crews out in that scenario, but it is one of those things when you go through flight attendant training, and it's an 8-week training. You learn how to combat.
Wow.
You know, how do I respond to any situation? Because anything that happens on the ground can happen in the air in that airplane. So, you know, to be able to be prepared and at least have those skills and to react. So,
well, of course, after 9/11, the U.S. doubled down on safety and security when it comes to air travel. But now, one of the big issues in airplane travel and crime is human trafficking. Significant, maybe even more insidious challenge for the industry to identify. You have taken on this issue in particular in your leadership role at Delta. So what's your motivation in doing that?
Yeah, I have a personal motivation. Our CEO, Ed Bastian, is passionate about the topic himself. He personally is involved in the fight and obviously wants Delta to be as well. For me, I, and this was all a part of my learning at Delta that I got from Delta, but we've been in the fight. Delta has since 2011. And we would have these awareness lunch and learns at Delta. And I had one Cindy McCain had come
John McCain's wife?
That's right. John mm-hmm. McCain's wife had come to, she was an advocate to help eradicate, and I'd been to that at Delta. And it was right about that time, my husband, who has a company just north of Atlanta, it was a Friday night, and one of his employees was crying on the other end of the phone, saying that her daughter, she felt like had just been trafficked in their neighborhood, and she was 12 years old.
Oh, my
and,
goodness.
You know, walking to a friend's house on a Friday night. And, you know, thankfully for me, I knew a little bit about it, and at least I knew these contacts from being at Delta and having sat through a lunch and learn. And to see a mother witness that from their daughter, you know, all over a Friday night, and to go through several days of not knowing, but knowing that it was, you know, trafficking was involved, and where is my daughter? And you know, when, you know, 5 days later, when they finally, you know, were able to get her home, you know, home wasn't the same place anymore. And so she went, and, you know, to South Georgia to live with her grandmother. And the more I've gotten, you know, having leading it now for Delta, the more you get involved in it and you think, okay, they've got, you know, they've been returned to their family, but there's so much more that comes with it when they get set free. They're, you know, they've got tattoos as a visible reminder. They've been drugged, so they've got a drug addiction possibly, or they've got a felony. And, you know, you just think about the courage that it takes a survivor. You think about what all they've had to endure. And then you come out thinking, okay, and it's not so okay for them. There's a huge recovery and restoration period that follows all of that, that I know for us at Delta, between 80,000 employees and 200 million customers we fly a year, we can absolutely do something to help in that space.
Well, so, how do you even recognize the signs? I mean, how can you tell if somebody is being trafficked?
Yeah, so there are several which we have educated. We have a training. We worked with Polaris, who runs the National Trafficking Hotline. So they're experts in the, you know, in the space, and they actually helped design the training for us at Delta. So we've had 56,000 of our 80,000 employees take it, because it doesn't matter, right? It can be in the community. Mm-hmm. It can be on board the airplane. It can be in the gate area. It can be when you're traveling on your layover as a crew member somewhere, you can spot it. But, you know, somebody who avoids eye contact, somebody else is speaking for them, you know, the nervousness. So those are several of the signs that we teach our teams, and also raising awareness with our customers to be on the lookout as well.
Right. Well, you've also, Delta helped survivors of human trafficking get home, apparently?
Yes. Delta matches, we donate Sky Miles to Polaris, and allow our customers to donate Sky Miles as well to Polaris. And Polaris actually gives those, they know who the survivors are. And so we've helped 57 victims get back to their families between our customers and Delta together. And that's one of the things that Ed charged me when I took it on. For several years, you know, we were sponsoring different venues and events, which was absolutely right, giving back to human trafficking. But what can we do that directly, how do we take a deeper stance, draw a line in the sand and help victims? And, you know, to know that we're, you know, have been able to help 57 just in a year's time is pretty phenomenal.
We're speaking with Allison Osmond, getting a sense of her life and her career at Delta. She's now Senior Vice President of In-Flight Service. Let's get back to the human trafficking for just a second, because Atlanta's hosting the Super Bowl, of course, next month. And it's described as America's biggest sex trafficking event, although there's some question about whether that's accurate. So what is Delta's focus then in the lead up to the Super Bowl?
Yeah, and I think we would say we've heard those same facts around the Super Bowl, but for us, it's about every day because we are getting reports now every day, you know, at Delta.
That's staggering.
It is staggering. But, you know, I think our responsibility is one of our five focus areas is to raise awareness, obviously with our, you know, Delta team, but with our customers. So really excited this month, and this started January 1, we have an in-flight video around human trafficking for the first time on our entertainment system on board the airplane. And, you know, it took some courage because it can be a really dark topic, and we, at the same time, right, we're a family airline too, and we want everybody to feel safe. But we worked really hard to create this in-flight video that really raises awareness of a trafficker and a victim on board the airplane. They're mm-hmm. sitting on board the airplane, and it's actually a young boy and an older man, and that will start to raise awareness. Our flight attendants are making an announcement, so our customers will hopefully go there. And then we've got signage in our airport gate areas that have the signs to look for. So really trying to raise that awareness with our customers.
We know that the Association of Flight Attendants reports that nearly one in five flight attendants say that they have actually been sexually assaulted. 70% say that they've been sexually harassed while in the air. So in this era of Me Too, how do you keep your Delta flight attendants safe while they're working?
It goes back to what I said earlier. Anything that happens on the ground, it happens in the air. And very, very mindful of that. As a matter of fact, with everything going on in the world today in the U.S. just this past year with the Me Too movement, have actually done a lot more in support of our flight attendants, both from a training perspective as well as just making sure that our process for the flight attendants to report situations, the immediacy of help once they get it, both in the air and on the ground, are all solid. So, and it's important.
Right. And what does the company culture do to encourage employees who have encountered, you know, problems, sexual harassment, assault in the air to do?
Yeah. So there we have, you know, and I think we have a compliance hotline that any employee can call, but ours is tell us immediately, notify us. And certainly from a flight attendant perspective, their process is to notify the cockpit immediately, mm-hmm. Get that cockpit engaged, and then from there, if we need to divert the airplane or if we need law enforcement to meet upon arrival, whatever it is, but there is a prescripted procedure that they follow. They have an onboard manual that has all their procedures in it, in their handheld, and it's a process that we want them to follow, but we want to know immediately.
So you've held several different leadership positions, flight attendant supervisor, leading reservation sales, customer relations, spearheading the first wave of social media-based customer care, and now you're senior vice president of in-flight service. So you've kept climbing. But I'm wondering, did many other women end up in those kind of leadership positions when you were moving up?
Yeah, I actually, when I first went into more of an administrative role in in-flight, shortly thereafter, I had the head of who had my job was a male at the time, but within 3 years' time, it was a female, mm-hmm. and she was clearly one of my mentors and still is today. She's retired from Delta, but she is still somebody that I stay in touch with today, and she inspired me every day, motivated me. It was wonderful to see her take on that role.
A much closer to you example of leadership is your dad, who I read it was the longtime mayor, is the longtime mayor of McDonough, Georgia, where you grew up.
He still is.
That's great. So what did you learn about leadership from him?
Oh, my goodness. A lot. You know, growing up in McDonough, Georgia, he worked in Atlanta for Southern Railway at the time, mm-hmm. but Norfolk Southern. And I watched him get up, and Atlanta seemed so far away, you know, back then, and watched him drive to work every day. And just to how, you know, his integrity, be kind to everybody. You know, I just watched him in that public servant space. Everybody was important, and still to this day. Everybody's important.
So now you are a woman who's at the top of your game and giving advice to others. So what would you say to a young flight attendant who sees you and would love to follow in your footsteps?
One, I would say, you know, just raise your hand. And again, this has been a part of my learning. I think a lot of times as a woman, you look at a project or a job and you go through the qualifications and it's, you know, well, I have this, I don't have this, I have this, I'm sort of good at this. You know what? Raise your hand. You can learn it. You can do it. You can sit around the table all day, but if you don't ever speak up, you don't get the respect. And I think the third thing is just, I think life is all about relationships, whether that's on the personal side or the business side. It's that network. And don't be afraid to use it. And, you know, by that meaning start your mentors. Get to know people, build relationships, and have mentors.
Words to the wise from Allison Osborne. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Sure. Thank you so much.
Allison Osborne, McDonough native and Senior Vice President for In-Flight Service at Delta. Stay with us. There's more on Second Thought coming up after a short break. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. More than 20 years after it opened off-Broadway, Hedwig and the Angry Inch is still daring, provocative, and moving.
Enemies and adversaries, they try and tear it out.
The show focuses on Hedwig Robinson, a German gender-fluid rock singer who navigates love, loss, and identity over the course of the production. Atlanta native Chad Darnell is stepping into the stilettos of the titular character in a new production. It's opening this weekend at the Pinch and Ouch Theater in Atlanta, and he's joining me in the studio. Chad, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So for people who don't know the show, can you give us a little synopsis of Hedwig and the Angry Inch?
The show is about 90 minutes, a rock concert, stand-up comedy. Hedwig has been traveling the country doing her show and telling about her life story.
Well, she's apparently inspired by a German female babysitter / prostitute, from what I read, who worked for John Cameron Mitchell's family when he was a teenager in Kansas. Just a fascinating sort of beginning. What was your initial experience, and how did you learn about Hedwig and the Angry Inch?
So I saw the movie in the early 2000s in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. So it was 2001 movie.
2001. And loved the movie. I had the soundtrack when I was working at Central Casting. I would play the soundtrack in my office. I wasn't really aware of the history of it with the workshops of the production in New York that John Cameron Mitchell had done at the Jane Hotel. And then years later, it's revived on Broadway, and I saw the production that came here to the Fox Theater and was blown away. And that night, as I was walking home, I was like, all right, I want to do this show because it's such a beast of a show.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. Really challenging.
Then I read that night John Cameron Mitchell like quit acting for years after he did the first version of it because it exhausted him so much. Darren Criss and Neil Patrick Harris both said, oh, this was like the hardest thing I've ever done. And I was like, great.
So you decided you want to do that?
I haven't acted in 20 years. Let's do that.
Well, let's get to that soon because you have been a casting director with a long resume behind you. But I want to know a little bit more about prepping for this. Really challenging role. You mentioned Neil Patrick Harris, who won a Tony, I think, for the role. Darren Criss, Ty Diggs, Michael C. Hall. You know, so how do you prepare for this kind of thing? Because there's a lot of different identities that you go through in the play.
Yes. First off, the story is everything. So the script, John Cameron Mitchell wrote an incredible script that gives you a lot of the history, but there's also a lot of history of the character that you don't know, which is what you get to figure out as the actor, which is great. And then just physically, it's a physically demanding role. Most men don't walk around in 7-inch heels. That's a lot of prep work. Physically, the stamina, it was a lot of really hard work of just physically getting into shape for the role. But also studying musicians, studying rock stars, Amy Winehouse, Courtney Love, Billy Joe Armstrong. Like really kind of what makes an artist, what makes a songwriter, why do they tell the stories that they tell? And in what order do they tell them as musicians? And that was really important to me as well, to really study rock and soulful lyricist.
Yeah, it is that sort of glam rock, you know, very out of this world.
David Bowie.
Yes, David Bowie style. Yeah, and that's another thing, the wigs, the makeup. Yeah. What does it feel like to sort of don this character, so to speak?
It's It's a lot of fun. I always have people on social media reach out to me. It's like, I'm playing Hedwig. Do you have any advice? I'm like, get used to the fact that you're going to have chipped
nail
polish.
You have black nails right now.
Chipped nail polish for, you know, 2 months, and everything that you own will be covered in body glitter. You just have to own that, and then it's fine.
How about your own learning how to play Hedwig? Who is Hedwig,
calls
herself. What did you learn? You played this character last year in Savannah. Yeah. So how did you learn from that experience that you're bringing into this production?
It was, I had about a year of prep time because we were actually thinking about doing a little earlier, but then I had more time because we pushed it. So during that time, it was really researching punk stars, all of that research that you go into physically getting into shape. So then we do the show and then you're away from it. Hmm. And as actors, we start to learn about things once we have distance from it. So, I mean, 2 months after the show, I was walking down the street and I was like, oh, that's what that thing meant. Mm-hmm. And you know, and it was frustrating. Like 6 months later, you'd be like, oh, that thing that was staring at me in the face the entire time, I didn't get that. And so you're frustrated. You almost feel bad for the audience. Like, oh my God, how did I not get that? And so that's when I'm really excited, because I feel like I've unearthed all these really great new gems. But I mean, it's also a sea of information that's the brilliance about his script is that there's so much there that every night you can discover something new about the show. Even Sunday night, Grant gave me this direction and I was like, I don't agree with that. That's wrong. And then I was in tears because I was like, oh, that's the thing I've been missing this entire time. It's awesome. That's what I love about acting.
Well, okay, so the show, it first premiered off-Broadway in 1998. Mm-hmm. Back then, cultural knowledge of LGBTQ issues, especially around gender fluidity, was pretty shallow. How do you think it's speaking to audiences today?
That's a really interesting point, because back during that time, there was hardly any conversation of trans. Mm-hmm. And we kind of looked at Hedwig just as a drag queen. And especially when you look at the 90s, a lot of representation of LGBTQIA characters in the media, it was drag queens and AIDS patients. That's all we really saw. Mm. There was no sort of networks and televisions and movies. They weren't writing roles for the gay people that you know in your life. And so when this movie came out, it was also the first time that we'd seen a character like this ever in film. And so I think that's why a lot of people are kind of drawn to the show now, even years later, because we remember that time in our history. Even though it was just 20 years ago when we saw it, it was such an incredible experience to see this character in the media at that point.
Well, I know when we were talking about it with the On Second Thought team prepping for the interview, we had a lot of questions in our little pod about, you know, is Hedwig to be called he or she? Is gender fluid the right term? Right. And we've had a number of debates about, LGBTQ, should the Q be used? Mm-hmm. Now, the story of Hedwig may not have changed in 20 years, but that conversation in the world around it has. So how do you think that changes the experience of the show, you know, for someone watching it, that they're thinking, oh, okay, I've seen this. This is somewhat familiar to me, but still, am I calling it the right thing?
Exactly. And John Cameron Mitchell has been very specific that Hedwig does not identify as trans. Hedwig identifies as genderqueer. So that sort of like piece of information was like, okay, so this is, we know where Hedwig identifies as the character, as the person. And for our community and for the conversations that we're having today, as we are starting to really understand how people identify, it is opening more conversations for people, especially after the show in Savannah. There were so many conversations with trans people who came to see the show because you don't want, some people are offended by the character and the transition and the fact that Hedwig does not identify as male. Sometimes Hedwig was referred to as he, and sometimes it's she. And Hedwig even identifies herself as he and she.
So sort of practice for all of us in
exactly,
some kind of way.
Yeah.
And I think that's interesting because I feel like I am afraid to get it wrong on some
we
level.
We all are.
Right?
Exactly. And I, you know, it's just a conversation that will continue to happen, but it's a conversation that, especially with how actors in Hollywood now, do we only cast trans actors now as trans actors? And yes, that would be great if we lived in a world and a society where an unknown trans actor could make a huge studio film. Unfortunately, the practicality of that, it's going to be a smaller budget just because they need a bankable movie star. And it doesn't matter if it's a trans actor or if it's a straight actor. They got to sell movies and they sell them with a name.
Well, this must be something you've thought about. You've worked as a casting director in film and TV before playing Hedvig, a gender fluid transitioning character. And there have been protests from the trans community when those roles do go to cisgender actors and actresses. I think of like Jeffrey Tambor in Transparent. And I remember, didn't Scarlett Johansson pull out of some role because people were giving her a lot of flack for playing a trans person? So you work with actors who transform themselves into a number of roles. So you just said, you know, you got to sell movies, but do you think, for identity's sake, there should be lines in the sand about who can play whom?
No. I know that's the unpopular answer because, but look at what Ryan Murphy did with Pose. He hired so many unknown trans actors and it was, I haven't seen the Golden Globes yet because I've been working on the show.
They happened Sunday night, I'll tell you that.
But I know that they were nominated, I know that it was nominated and it was a brilliant show.
And
I
he
loved
wore
the show.
A fantastic outfit on the red carpet, by the way.
Good. But you know, that was a brilliant show and they highlighted and showcased trans actors and it worked. So that was a huge payoff for the trajectory of where we're going. And I hope that we can continue to do those roles. Darren Criss just recently came out in an interview and said that he's not going to take any more gay roles because he doesn't want to take those away from gay actors. Mm. He's been very successful. Glee, Hedwig, The Assassination of Gianni Versace. Like, he's been very successful doing those roles. But I don't think, I mean, yes, it sounds great and an actor makes their own choices in the roles that they want to play. But I think if you're an actor, you're an actor.
So you're a casting director. Would you have cast you as Hedwig?
Absolutely.
I'm speaking with the Atlanta native Chad Darnell. He's starring in a new production of Hedwig and the Angry Inch. What's your favorite song from the production?
Origin of Love.
Okay, let's hear some of that.
Oh.
So why do you love this song so much?
There's a moment that happens in the song where it just starts the show for me, Chad, the actor, in a trajectory to get to the end game at the end of the show. Mm. And it's a beautiful little, just a little private moment as the actor that some people catch and some people don't. And if you don't catch it, that's fine. But when you do and you realize what happens at the end, it's people cry. And I like that.
Okay, so we're not going to give away any spoilers there, but that this has a whole sort of mythological origin to it, too. I don't know. How are you in mythology? Do you want to explain this kind of origins of love idea?
No, it's based on Plato's...
I think the Symposium?
Yes. And there is the mythology in the show. The way that I sort of interpret it for me, Chad, the actor in the show, is the relationship between Hedwig and Tommy.
Okay. So this is a musical, of course, mm-hmm. and the character is a rock star. Mm-hmm. And singing takes the human voice, human communication to a whole other level. Hedwig absolutely bursting with longing and disappointment and ambition. So could this story be the same or told if the character didn't break into song?
No. No, it would be a really sad little show. The music is so much a part of it, but also, without giving away the ending, Hedwig basically becomes music, if that makes sense. And if it doesn't, then
someone's
going
to have to come
see
the show. Okay, so how about for you as a person who's cast so many, you've done work in Selma, Magic Mike. You worked on Mercy Street. It's a PBS production, which, by the way, I do want to note, is airing tonight on GPB television. But what kind of things do you consider when you're casting for a production? What are you looking for in an actor? Is it the role or the actor?
The actor. Yeah. For me, it's always the actor first. And I love getting to start new projects because you get to start with a fresh slate. So an actor that might not be right for this movie is perfect for the next one. And it depends if it's a period film, then I'm looking for classical faces. I'm looking for natural bodies. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's if you're in the 19 or the 1800s, you probably wouldn't have bleached blonde hair and physical alterations, tattoos, that kind of thing. So just looking at a breakdown, it's I'm looking for the actor first. But also, and I think what served me well is that I want good people, because when you're on a film set, and I spent many years in extras casting, and now I'm a principal casting director, I'm casting the speaking parts. When you're on set for 18 hours a day, you want good, kind people around you all day long. So the makeup and hair people don't want to deal with a diva. And I had a conversation with the director just last week. He's like, well, I don't mind the divas. And I said, you might not, but the caterers do. Mm. And you want to keep those people happy. So that's like, that's one of the things. I believe there's enough roles for everybody to go around. So why not cast good people?
Do you have a favorite casting experience?
I love Magic Mike XXL. I got to say, that was like summer camp. It was because it was, I did the extras and the principals. Channing Tatum couldn't have been nicer. Steven Soderbergh, getting to work with Steven Soderbergh and watching him edit the movie in the hotel room. In the hotel lobby every night was incredible. We shot in Savannah, traveled to Myrtle Beach. It was just, I mean, they're all great. And I had 5 seasons of Alias with J.J. Abrams, Crossing Jordan. I mean, I'm still friends with everybody that was on that show. It's sad now that we're getting together for funerals when people pass away. But we're all still in touch. And they're all great experiences.
But now you're on stage, a completely different experience. Yeah. How is that energy different?
It's fun because what I grew up as an actor. I was a little kid actor, and then I fell into casting completely by accident. But it was my life's journey, because there weren't a lot of roles for my type back in the early 90s. There are now. But I got a great education in casting, producing, writing, which has been helpful for me. But, you know, now that I get to do the acting thing, and especially with this role, I love my favorite thing. I've never been interested in acting for fame. I don't want to be famous. It's nothing like that. What I love about acting and what I get to love, because every day that I'm casting, I'm in a casting session, I get to act opposite another actor. I'm reading opposite the other act. So I get to act 8 hours a day. But I love the trickery part of acting. I love where at the end of a show, there's no greater high than an audience member or a friend come up and say, I didn't see any of you in that character. Mm. The voice physically, you completely convince somebody that you are somebody completely different. That's what I love about it. It's the trickery part of acting that I love.
So Chad Darnell, he's going to be disappearing into Hedwig, we hope. Thank you so much for being with
Thank
us.
Thank you.
He's going to be playing Hedwig in Hedwig and the Angry Inch at the Pinch and Ouch Theater in Atlanta. That's starting this weekend, and the show's running through February. And that's our show for today. We do have a special request for you. If you are somebody who's been directly affected by the government shutdown, or you feel like we all will be, let us know. We're at OST Talk. You can go to our Facebook group. We're looking for folks to tell their story about the impact for them. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. This is On Second Thought.